This is 89.1 WEMU, and welcome to Issues of the Environment. I'm David Fair, and every Wednesday we cover a topic of importance when it comes to the health and well-being of our environment. For the past several summers, we've witnessed huge algae blooms on Lake Erie. Another is expected this year. And Lake Erie certainly isn't the only waterway that spends some of the warmer months inhabited by these blooms. But something I didn't know, some of the toxins from these blooms can end up airborne and travel well inland, creating even more potential consequences. My guest today is Andrew Ault. Andrew is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Chemistry. He's been researching this very topic and joins us today to fill us in on what is known to this point. Andrew, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
What have you heard so far as a forecast for algae blooms on Lake Erie and Lake Michigan for this summer? Is it going to be as bad as we have come to expect?
Well, we certainly had a lot of rain this spring, which essentially leads to a lot of fertilizer runoff and other sorts of runoff to give the nutrients to help these blooms grow in the lake. And so we're certainly expecting it to at least be an average, if not above average, year. But there's always some degree of unpredictability ahead of time.
Of course. And as far as the impact on the inhabited waters, we only need to think back to 2014 when a Lake Erie bloom contaminated the Toledo water supply, leaving thousands of northern Ohio and southern Michigan residents without clean drinking water for days. The blooms on Lake Michigan haven't been as severe, at least not yet, right?
Yes, that's correct. We have had some blooms in southern Lake Michigan, particularly in These blooms really thrive on areas where the water can get a bit warmer, so sort of coastal areas where you have some of these waters sort of become more stagnant and a little more shallow, you're able to have more of these blooms. But the deeper waters of sort of central Lake Michigan haven't really been impacted too much to this point yet. But we can also have them further north up in Saginaw Bay as well, you know, sort of the southern Lake Huron area and Lake St. Clair. So they certainly get around the lakes.
And do those blooms have the potential to become as severe as what we've witnessed on Lake Erie?
Well, Lake Erie is a pretty unique habitat in the fact that you have really shallow waters, which helps them warm quite easily in compared to, say, Lake Superior, which is both further north but also much deeper and so much cooler. That being said, we do see blooms in these other areas that I've mentioned, and they can be quite severe at times. We certainly do see elevated levels of microcystin, which is one of the main toxins we worry about. One of the challenges we have is that predicting which blooms will have the most toxins is something that is still a very active area of research.
And I want to get into that research that you're conducting now. It makes perfect sense, but it hadn't really crossed my mind in the years that we've been covering the Erie blooms. What prompted you to look into whether some of those toxins from these blooms were becoming airborne?
My background, actually, as a postdoc, I did quite a bit of work on oceanic blooms, red tides you may have heard of.
Red tides, right.
So when I moved to Michigan and got started in 2013, I realized that no one had ever really looked to see if anything was getting out of these blooms in Lake Michigan or Lake Erie, any of the Great Lakes. There has been some little bit of work on inland lakes. What we wanted to dive into was to see, you know, we have these materials there. We do see some, you know, we see waves, particularly once we get into late summer, September time period when you start, you know, the lakes start to turn over. And there's a lot of potential at that point for the material to get airborne, but it just really hadn't been studied yet. And so that was something that sort of my background, I was prepared to do. And we started doing about 3-4 years ago.
Issues of the Environment and our conversation on toxic algae blooms and the potential for airborne hazards continues on 89.1 WEMU. So when you want to test, not all months are available for that kind of testing. How exactly did you go about looking for the likelihood of airborne toxins?
Go about this in sort of a couple of different ways. One of the first is that we, when we were making a measurement right above the lakes, you can have a lot of different sources of material in the atmosphere, particulate matter, we often call it. So that can be from any number of sources. So what we did is we actually have a small aerosol generator, we call it, which is a fancy phrase for a tank in the lab that we can very precisely generate material from the water that would be this, under the same conditions as it would have in the lake. And when we do it back in the lab, we're able to do it without any other sources around. And so that lets us really know this is what's actually coming out of the water.
That's a lot of lab evidence. Now, are you planning on being out on the Great Lakes this summer for further testing?
Absolutely, yes. And so we actually, there were two prongs to this. So we do our studies back in the lab, but we also go out and do measurements right along the coast. Our first work on this was actually not even during a bloom, but just during a wave event on Lake Michigan a couple of years ago. We sort of started with that, and now we're working with the Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality this summer to get samples from a number of different both Great Lake and Inland Lake areas that are susceptible to blooms. And so we'll be working with that. And then in the future, our goal is to go out and make more measurements next to the blooms at the times that we know that they're generating more potentially harmful toxins.
Understanding that in the scientific process, we're still in the relative early stages. But based on what you've discovered so far, have we made any kind of determination as to how far inland the winds can take these toxins?
That's a great question. Yes. So what we know is that particles that are generated from the Great Lakes, such as Lake Michigan or Superior, we know that they can be transported easily 30 or 40 kilometers inland. We've actually have a paper coming out just in the next week or two that will show things from Lake Superior being transported to our University of Michigan biological station, Pelson, for example, which is up near the tip of the Mitt. These aerosols that get generated from wave breaking can be transported long distances. We actually have a separate study where we saw particles come all the way from Hudson Bay down, for example, to Lake Michigan. And the type of analysis we do, we're very uniquely able to see sort of a fingerprint of where these things have come from. And based on that fingerprint, it's kind of like particle forensics, we're able to go back and figure out where the particle has come from. And so based on those, we have every expectation that the types of particles, if we do have a wave event during at the end of one of these blooms, we have every expectation that the particles should be able to get transported. But again, as you mentioned before, this is still early in the process. And so, there's still a lot of measurements still to make.
Once again, you're listening to Issues of the Environment on 89.1 WEMU, and we're talking with Andrew Ault. He is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan in the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Chemistry. And Andrew, if you find that there is evidence of airborne toxins being carried significant distances inland, what can actually be done about it? You can't stop the wind.
No, it's one of those things that in the air pollution world, we often say pollution, just knows no boundaries. It is going to go where the winds are going to take it.
What are the potential health ramifications for those who might be exposed via airborne toxins?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, and I don't want to sound too alarmist. So with that caveat, one of the things we worry about is that when we inhale these toxins, we're actually more susceptible to potential health consequences than if we were to, say, drink them, such as if we were to have, the microcystins were in the Toledo water supply. Because of that, we still need to do studies to understand it. The most likely consequences would be sort of exacerbation of existing respiratory issues. There's been some studies sort of recreational users who, say taking jet skis through blooms, that end up having these sorts of conditions slightly worsened. But I should caveat that there's a lot that's unknown at this point and that we need to do more work to really fully grasp this because it's a source that people have not really considered previously.
But in the end, as we start to seek out and search for those solutions, what we do know is probably where we need to go, and that is that we have to center our attention on the point sources, right? Agricultural runoff, phosphorus that's been cited as the biggest contributing factors for algal blooms. What relationship will your future research have to getting those issues better addressed?
That is the million-dollar question. One of the challenges is that we just see, when it comes to the runoff, we see a lot of soluble phosphorus in particular, and finding ways to limit the number of nutrients getting into the Great Lakes or these other inland lakes that can have very unique environments as well. Some of our work that we've proposed to do will hopefully be down at Grand Lake St. Mary's in Ohio, which is sort of a classic example of the fact that you can have other things beyond the sort of microcystins forming. It really depends on the biology of the bloom. And what we would like to do is to both understand sort of what are the conditions that lead to the different toxins, and then that's, I think, a general question that many people are interested in. And our group specifically is quite interested in, do specific toxins get out more easily, or are they enhanced in the aerosol? Are they in the same concentrations in the water, or are they depleted? And what is their stability? If they're traveling, 30, 40 miles inland, do we need to worry about, are they going to persist, or are they going to break down during that transport time period? And therein lies a lot of the questions that we're trying to deal with. But in the long term, get back to your question, The lakes aren't going to be getting any cooler anytime soon. And so, you know, trying to figure out ways to limit the amount of nutrients getting into the lakes is, at the end of the day, you know, the biggest goal that we need to have.
Well, certainly we hope that this summer will bring greater understanding through the course of your research, and perhaps we'll have an opportunity down the line when that is published to further discuss it.
That would be fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed getting to chat with you about this.
Thank you, Andrew. We do appreciate it. That is Andrew Ault, assistant professor at the University of Michigan in the Departments of Environmental Health Sciences and Chemistry. I'm David Fair, and I invite you to join us next Wednesday for another edition of Issues of the Environment. It's a weekly feature conversation, and you'll find it only on 89.1 WEMU-FM and WEMU-HD1 Ypsilanti.